Good.
And my name is Natalie Peters, and this is June 30th, 1994, and I'm here at Charles Spang in Aberdeen. And start anywhere you'd like, Mr. Spang. We could start with what brought your family to this area?
My mother was born and raised in the town of Aberdeen. She attended the local schools, went to Towson State Normal School, which is now Towson University. And when she finished there, she was a school teacher in Harford County. I've heard her say that the first year she taught school, she taught at Robin Hood School, and she made $300 a year. And of course, there were dirt roads at that time. It says she rode the Pennsylvania Railroad train from Aberdeen to Swan Creek and walked from Swan Creek to Robin Hood School. That winter, she wore out 3 pair of Arctics.
Do you recall what year that was about? Her
that
first
would
year?
Have been probably 1905 or thereabouts. My father was born in Austria. He attended University of Budapest, passed veterinarian school for 1 year, and then his family moved to Philadelphia. At that point, he eventually attended the University of Pennsylvania, graduating from the veterinary school at the University of Pennsylvania. He then came to the town of Aberdeen to practice veterinary medicine. He and my mother were married about 1910 and 1912. His practice composed of the area which is now occupied as the Aberdeen Proving Ground. In 1916, 1917, most of that area, which was farmland, was taken over by the government, and the farmers were put out of business, and likewise, my father's practice was practically eliminated. At that point, he became involved in Bell's Pharmacy, and in 1922 purchased Dell's Pharmacy from Dr. T.A. Cronin. The pharmacy is still owned by the Spang family. However, there is a transition taking place by where the business is taken over by other people.
Was your father the pharmacist?
My father owned the pharmacy and worked in the pharmacy, but he was not a pharmacist per se. He was a veterinarian. Due to my brother's death and my age, he felt it was best to dispose of the pharmacy. However, it has been a very interesting experience through the years. The Depression years were catastrophic, so much so that the business declined to a point where it was almost closed.
Now, you remember the Depression personally?
I do remember the Depression. It was, at that point, I was young, inexperienced, and money meant nothing. However, my mother and father were always able to clothe us and feed us. We had nothing else. Sometimes I treasure that experience.
That's so.
Even though we had no money, we had our health, and the family was very close. So the fact we had no money was an inconvenience, but it really didn't affect my attitude or life.
Do you remember any specific experiences that...
There were many things that I would like to have had as a young boy, but there was no money to buy.
Right, like what kinds of things?
And I accepted it as such and went on my merry way.
What kinds of things do you recall now?
Well, when you're young, there are certain things you want, such as a shotgun or certain types of clothing, ice skates, enough money to buy shells so that you could hunt. At about age 15 or 16, a man gave me a rabbit dog, and I had enough friends that I was able to borrow guns so that I could rabbit hunt. And I always enjoyed that, and I remember that when I was about 21 years old, I was able to save up enough money to buy a 12-gauge shotgun, and I still have that gun today. You want to put a pause on that? Some people are inexperienced in the procedures for rabbit hunting.
Mm-hmm.
When a rabbit is kicked up out of the brush and chased by a rabbit dog, it always comes back to the place from when it got up. So when you kick a rabbit up, you'd get out, there'd be several people with you, and you'd spread out, and the dog would trail the rabbit up through the woods or fields, and then the rabbit would come back to where it got up, and at that point, hopefully, you were able to kill it.
And did you skin the rabbits yourself and cure the skins?
Oh yes, we would skin the rabbit, prepare it, and soak it in salt water, get the blood out of it, and then of course my mother would prepare it for supper.
Would you fry it or roast it, or how did you cook the rabbit meat?
I'm not too sure, but I think probably it was a parboiled and then fried.
Mm-hmm.
But it was excellent eating, very tender, and of course a lot of people today wouldn't touch them.
Right.
It was excellent. Same way with wild duck. You fortunate enough to get to a place where you kill some wild duck, you bring them home, pick them, clean them, and roast them. I had quite a lot of friends that used to take me duck hunting, and in later years I was with a group on goose hunting, and I always enjoyed it. I did discontinue this sport several years ago, and I think maybe I stopped at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Pete, about the duck hunting, obviously it's a lot different now. I mean, that's to say you saw a lot more kinds of ducks and so forth?
Well,
in the early years
that I went duck hunting, there were canvasback ducks, which was a very prominent and excellent book. Found mostly on the Susquehanna Flats. I had an opportunity to get into a sink box once in my life.
Can you describe a sink box to me?
A sink box was a like a sunken coffin, and it had wings on it so that the water wouldn't come in and sink the box. And then you would put several hundred wooden decoys around the sink box, and then the big boat would go back and let the hunter stay in that sink box, and as the ducks came in against the wind, you would raise up and attempt to kill them. That was a very, very lucrative sport for people that owned those rigs. Many people would come down out of Philadelphia, New York, Wilmington, and pay substantial fees for a day's duck hunting. Also, there was quite a bit of duck hunting done down on the proving ground on the shorelines of the former farms. So it was an experience that I really treasure.
How many ducks would be brought in an average day?
Whatever the limit was at that time. In my younger years, the limit was rather attractive. But then in my later years, you're only allowed one or two.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows what has happened.
Right.
There are no longer any canvasback ducks around on the Susquehanna Flats. The Susquehanna Flats are still there, but they're non-existent.
How many would the flocks number in those days of canvasbacks?
Well, in my day, maybe 10, 20. Mm-hmm. In the earlier years, there would be large mm-hmm. bunches, flying large bunches. But in my time, they didn't have those real large mm-hmm. bunches flying. That was in the demise of the canvasback duck. Really, old-time hunters have said that the demise of the canvasback duck was caused by the construction of the Conowingo Dam. The Conowingo Dam had an impact on the ebb and flow of the tide. Conowingo Dam has had a tremendous impact on the shad and herring. The Susquehanna River afforded a lot of shad, rockfish, and herring when they would come up the Susquehanna River to spawn. That was a very lucrative business.
That's what I want. So go ahead you recall did you used to fish at all on the river there?
No, I did not.
Okay, but you had...
That was before my time,
mm-hmm.
really.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very lucrative business. I guess the largest fishing organizations or outfits would go out of Harvey Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be big scows, and as I understand it.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the fisherman's market? People bring the fish in to sell the fish?
No, that would have been ahead of my time. Mm-hmm. Well, in later years, there were people that had Chad and so forth, you could go to Haverty Grace and go down along the shoreline to Strong's Fish Market and buy fish that had just been brought in that day.
Shad and rockfish.
Shad, rockfish, herring. Years ago, people would buy herring, which was extremely inexpensive, and take it home and put it in a smokehouse and smoke it, put it on a stick, hang it up, and then smoke it, and then eat smoked herring. That was a delicacy.
Did you all ever smoke your own herring, your family? Mm-hmm.
I was never, but I had neighbors that smoked herring, and I remember that. I was a small boy at that time. Mm-hmm. After I finished high school, I went to college for several years and then ended up going to a business college during the summer months. I was fortunate enough to be able to get a job on the Baltimore, Ohio Railroad in the maintenance way department. My pay for six full days was $19.78 a week. Well, that was excellent money in 1934-35. And my parents did not let me spend any of that money. I set that aside for my school education.
What were your responsibilities on your job? What did you do?
In the railroad, at that point they were replacing a lot of rail that had worn out, and I kept a lot of records of the material. I was on a work train loading and unloading the materials and rail. I ran a small motor car for the track supervisor. We would go from Aberdeen to Baltimore, or from Aberdeen to Newark, Delaware. It was an excellent experience, and one that I should never forget.
What kind of men were you working with? Were they also local young men?
A lot of black men, very few white, but they all became good friends of mine. And you'd start work about 7 o'clock in the morning and work till 4, 4:30.
Do you remember any individuals?
Well, all the individuals that I knew have passed away. Mm-hmm. They were all good to me, and I feel that I had the ability to make friends with most anyone.
Do you remember any specific experiences on that job?
No, nothing particular. Other than I did like the work. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being on the outside at that point instead of being in someplace else in an office. After I finished business college, I was fortunate enough to get a job with the General Insurance Agency, known as Melville Scott & Son at that point. As a bookkeeper, and from that I learned the general insurance business, being fire, automobile, and general casualty.
Did you just decide that that's the business you wanted to go into, or did you have a personal contact? How did you get that job?
I had the owner of the agency needed someone to keep the books and was interested in finding some young fellow that would be interested in the business. I always feel that I was just fortunate to be at the right spot at the right time. I worked there from 1938 to 1941, and at that point I had to go in the Army for 4 years. And when I came back out of the Army, I was fortunate enough to be able to get back into the same insurance agency, and in 1946, the name was changed from Melville Scott & Son to Famous & Spine Associates.
1946?
So
that would have been only about a year after you came back?
Yeah. During the time that I was away in the service, Mr. Scott passed away, and this changed things around a lot. The insurance business has been very interesting. A lot of hard work. I've made a lot of friends. In 1981, I sold the agency to my daughter and son-in-law, and Charles Ramsey, and have stayed on as a producer and have serviced some of the accounts that I had serviced during my working years.
You must have accounts that you've had for a long time.
Pardon?
You must have accounts that you've had for a long time.
I have some. Of course, a lot of the accounts that I wrote years ago, the people are no longer around.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had some very nice accounts. People have been very nice to me. When I returned from the service, people in the county and town remembered it and showed their appreciation by letting me handle their accounts. During the war, I was with the 8th Infantry Division.
Can you tell me about that?
I was fortunate enough to get some breaks while I was in the service. I went in as a private, came out as a captain. I guess I was at the right spot at the right time.
Sounds like you've got a talent for that.
Pardon?
Sounds like you've got a talent for that.
Yeah. Somebody's been pretty nice to me through the years.
Can you tell me about some of those promotions? That's quite a jump for 4 years in the service.
As I said, I went overseas with the 8th Infantry Division in 1943. We went to Ireland and stayed in Ireland until we loaded on a ship after D-Day and landed on the Normandy Beach, Omaha Beach, on the morning of July the 4th, 1944. That experience was quite an experience. As I say, I was not in the initial phase or the landing on June the 6th, but July the 4th was only 28 days later. And
can you give us a visual picture of that?
Well, no, not exactly, other than I remember the entire division unloaded off the shores of Normandy all night long, down over rope ladders, and then jumped into landing craft and were taken in to shore, and the front end of the landing craft dropped down, and you stepped off into the water and walked on up the beach. The resistance was not there like it was on D-Day. and we went down through Normandy.
What was
we were committed on July the 12th, as I recall, and the division, I was assigned to division headquarters. I was not pinned down in the regiments, but went down through Normandy, up through Brittany Peninsula.
And what was your rank at this time?
A captain at that point. Mm-hmm. We went from Brittany to Luxembourg by rail, what they call 40 and 8s.
What does that mean?
That's a train.
Oh, I see.
Freight cars.
Okay.
They call them 40 men or 8 horses. That's 40 and 8s. That's what they were called. We were in Luxembourg for a short period of time, and then moved up into the Hurtgen Forest. At the time of the Battle of the Bulge, which went directly through Luxembourg, we were on the edge of Germany in the Hurtgen Forest. But it was cold weather, snowy. Quite an experience.
Can you tell me something about, more about that?
Not a whole lot. And then we went later, as the war progressed, and the Battle of Bulge, was resolved. We went across the Ruhr River, across over to the Rhine River.
How did you cross the rivers, by train or?
The troops made a crossing at the Ruhr River at Aachen, and then and that would have been the infantry regiments.
You mean you actually
when went? We went across, we would go across on Ponton Bridge. The Rhine River we crossed also right after the Remagen Bridgehead was taken. And that shortened the war tremendously. I remember one thing, when we went across the Rhine River on these pontoon bridges, there was a sign and had quite an impact on everybody, I'm sure. The sign said, "Over this bridge pass the finest men and material in the world." Well, that made you feel like you were really something. And we went on up the Rhine Valley, across the Elbe River, and then on May the 7th, we met all the German people, troops, everything. The capitulation of the war, they were trying to get any place they could where it was safe. It was hard for the convoys to move because of all the troops coming in the opposite direction. People, horses, wagons, it was something really remarkable.
Now you mean German people, right?
That's right.
And these were these civilians or?
Some civilians, that's right. Everybody, mm-hmm. Children and all. And then we went, and the war ended up when we were up at the Baltic coast. So, I'm put that on.
I want to ask you, can you tell me, again, give me sort of a more visual picture of these civilians, the Germans coming back, and the I imagine also their military personnel. What was the feeling like with the troops?
Of course, you, there was no conversation.
Right.
But you could sense that they were glad that the war was over. And it got so bad that eventually they just put pushed them over into big fields, and that's where they stayed. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was our responsibility, or the Americans.
Jim, please take a call on line two. Jim?
It was Americans' responsibility to feed these people, and that was a big, big task. I wasn't involved, but I do know what happened.
Tell me about that.
Being that the people, there were so many people mm-hmm. coming in the opposite direction that American troops couldn't move through. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how they got the food to the people? Were they feeding them MREs or?
Well, they were feeding them our rations, as I understand it. But I wasn't personally involved in it. I came back out of the service in the fall of 1945.
Where did you actually come in when you returned? Can you tell me about your return from Europe?
Oh, let's see. We came back by a Liberty ship. We came back into Norfolk, Virginia, and were supposed to have indirect redeployment to the Pacific. The war was not over, just the war in Europe was over. We had 30 days leave and then went back to Fort Meade and got on the troop train to go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri to reassemble. The war ended that afternoon and we pulled into Pennsylvania Station on our way to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. It was announced officially that the entire war was over in Europe and of course Pacific was over too. And everybody was hilarious. The troops got off of the trains and went up through the stations and I guess we were an hour before everybody got back on the train and went to Fort Leonard Wood.
Describe that.
We were supposed to go to Fort Lewis, Washington in September to be sent to the Pacific, but of course that was all called off in Kansas.
But you actually made it to Kansas?
Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri.
Missouri.
We went out there, the entire division went back out there and reassembled.
So how long were you there?
Well, I was there just 2 months before they started separating them. And the people were discharged at that point based on points. In other words, how long you'd been in the service, how long you'd been overseas, and how many campaigns you participated in.
Do you remember?
I always had enough. I don't remember exactly what the formula was, right. But I had adequate points to get out. I knew that.
What was it like waiting to go home for 2 months?
Well, it was rather trying, and you had some suspense and things of that nature. But I meant, you'd been in the service so long, you didn't know any better, and you assumed it. So. My entire military experience was not what some people experienced. I was more fortunate. Some of them didn't get back. Mm-hmm. I always felt that I was fortunate that I was with ground troops and that I was with an infantry division, which I was far enough forward that I knew what was going on. I guess I would say I was fortunate that I was not with a regiment or company in the front lines. I probably wouldn't be here today. Mm-hmm. After I came back out of service, I came into the insurance business and
tell me what you thought what kind of changes you saw between the time that you left for your military service and the time you came back.
Well, I guess I was young. At that point, I was not married. After I came back out of service, I met my present wife, and I guess I was married in 1946. Better not guess about that. I was married in 1946.
We'll put that in as part of the record.
The insurance business has been a very interesting experience. I formed a partnership with Curtis Famous, who lived in Bel Air, and we were together for 22 years, and he passed away, and we had an arrangement wherein I took over the agency and paid his family off. We had excellent help, and everybody worked hard, and we were able to build the agency to a sizable volume of business. This building that you're in now was put up in 1960. Ahead of that, we had an office over Beely's Lumber and Hardware business on Philadelphia Boulevard. Of course, I was there from 1938 to 1960, except for the war years. And we've been in this location since 1960, so that's 34 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I only work part-time. So any time I'm spending with you is free time. So I've been involved with the church activities. Involved with the Aberdeen Fire Department, and I'm a life member of the fire department.
Can you tell me about some of your...
I guess I've been a member of the fire company over 50 years.
Can you tell me about some of your experiences with the fire company?
Well, my experiences as a real young boy was a firefighter. I might say, and this is reminiscing, that I remember the old firehouse, and they did not have a whistle as an alarm, but had a gong in front of the building. And when there was whether it was a fire, why, somebody would take a hammer and hit that gong, and you could hear it all over the town. It was the town of Aberdeen. Was nowhere near as large as it is today.
You were a volunteer?
I was a volunteer, and it is still a volunteer organization. After the war, I got into the administrative end of the fire company. Was secretary and treasurer for quite a few years, president of the company for quite a few years, board of directors for quite a few years. I think in 1976 or thereabouts, I relinquished any activities and let the younger group take over. But I still have a life membership and carry a card as such. It might be interesting to know that the county has a pension plan for certain people after they qualify. Well, I was one of the first ones to qualify for the pension plan. And I understand that perhaps in the next month or so we're going to get an increase. So that's
deserted.
It's not a large sum of money, but it certainly shows recognition and appreciation.
Deserved recognition.
I've served on the board of directors of First National Bank of Aberdeen. I think it was in 1956 that I was asked to serve on the board. And that was a very interesting experience. However, in 1963, the First National Bank of Aberdeen merged with Equitable Trust Company. And we operated for many years on an autonomous manner. Very interesting. They didn't take any of our authority away from us. However, due to chain of events, why things gradually changed and we didn't have the authority that we used to have. However, I still serve on the advisory board. It went from First Equitable Trust Company to Maryland National Bank, and then Maryland National Bank to Nations Bank. So the banking industry nationwide has changed drastically.
Counsel, can you give me some details? Can you give me some details about that?
Well, really, I don't guess other than as a unit bank, I would say that it was much more interesting. You had more authority. You had a responsibility that you did not have after you merged with the other bank.
It being a local bank, did you deal with the people in the town personally, more personally?
It was a much closer relationship. You made loans, you approved loans, you disapproved loans, people that worked in the bank were employees of the bank. It's what you would classify as a unit bank, and you ran the show. That has all changed. This didn't only happen to the banking industry, this has happened to all industries. All companies have merged and sold out.
Can you describe for me the changes that you've seen in Aberdeen and the businesses and the personal life here?
Of course, there have been tremendous changes in the community going back from the time I started, because in the early days was a horse and buggy days, and that changed to the automobile, changed to a network of roads instead of dirt roads.
Do you remember the early automobiles coming in?
Yes, I remember.
Who was the first
person?
There
were many people that didn't own an automobile. Mm-hmm. On today's market, everybody has two or three automobiles.
Who was the first person you remember to get a car?
Well, of course, the automobile was in existence
right. When
I came along, but there were many people that didn't
right. Have
enough money to buy one. But if somebody got a new car, that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the first car my brother and I bought was a used car, and we paid $25 for it.
Do you remember what kind of car it was?
It was a Chevrolet Roadster, 1929 model. And we drove that for 6 or 7 years, and we're thankful to have it. change so much in that direction. I feel like I've been blessed. I'm not bragging, I don't mean to brag, it's just a chain of events. People own automobiles. Of course, as I came along, there used to be grocery stores, independent grocery stores. You'd go to a grocery store and buy whatever kind of meat you wanted, and they'd cut it the way you wanted it. Today, you go to the market and you buy what's on in the counter or on the shelf. I can remember Adams' store, which was down Bel-Air Avenue. You'd see chickens, turkeys, hanging outside the store for sale. You know, of course, the health department wouldn't permit such a thing today.
And you just go and select whatever it is that appealed to you there, and or did you do it by order or what?
Well, in those years, the grocery store had a delivery truck. You could call and order what you wanted, and they'd deliver it to you. Of course, that's non-existent today. But of course, there were many people that went to the store and purchased what they wanted and brought it home, but you did have access to a delivery truck.
And you had your milk delivered separately?
Milk was delivered by the dairy, and every morning the milk was delivered. And that's gone out of existence.
Can you describe, give us sort of a visual picture of what Aberdeen looked like then, with the kinds of businesses and those early days that you can remember?
There are some pictures available. Colonel's Choice Restaurant and in the pump room have a lot of pictures of the original streets and buildings in the town of Aberdeen, and it's really worthwhile for a person to go down there and see what is there. The pictures of Bel-Air Avenue with automobiles, which of course were a vintage of maybe 1917 or 1918 models. And I think there are one or two pictures of showing dirt roads on Bel-Air Avenue. In the past few years, they've created what they call an Aberdeen Room, which is a historical room. And they have acquired and gotten together many old pictures, many old items. And it's really worthwhile for a person to go to this Aberdeen Room and see what's going on. I might retrace one item. The town of Aberdeen is extremely active in the canning industry, canned goods being, and they can the shoe peg corn. There were four or five factories in this locality, and that was a very lucrative business.
Who worked in those factories?
Most of the people there, the factory would can most of their corn latter part of July, August, and September. And most of the help came out of Baltimore. And they had shanties or places where these people stayed during the canning season. They were happy to come up here to get out of the city. They didn't make much money, but whatever they made, they were able to keep.
Were these entire families that came up?
I would say a lot of times the entire family would come up. Or maybe just the husband, depending on the size of the family.
And do you remember the ethnicity of these people?
Most of them were Lithuanians. I just don't know. They came out of East Baltimore.
Where was the factory located?
Well, there were several of them. One was right up here with the B&L Railroad. One was down the Smith Michael factory was down by the Proving Ground Road, and you had C.B. Osborne up on Route 40. F.O. Mitchell was a Pangman. Then there were some factories that, very small factories that canned tomatoes. One at Carson's Run. Sometimes there was one up at Elsner's at Webster.
Was it common for these people, the workers that had come up, to interact in the community?
No, they did not get involved with the community. But now, the factories, the small plants, like on a farm, neighbors would come in and all get together and can of tomatoes or things like that. But the corn, they had to bring people out of the city to help. That was a pretty good size operation.
So you didn't play with any of the children who came up with their parents?
No, the families stayed to themselves around the factory. That's where their quarters were.
What else do you remember about being a young person in Aberdeen? What kind of activities did you all play games or ice skating?
We ice skated at Krause's Pond. And then we did a lot of sledding up on Krause's Hill. That was during my younger years. We played touch football over at Silver's Lot, which is right across the street from here on Bel-Air Avenue.
How would you get a game started?
After school in the afternoon, everybody get together and have a big time. We had school activities such as soccer and baseball. They didn't have football in those days. But it didn't take much to entertain us.
Do you remember who were your big heroes in those days? Who were the people that were really important in your life?
I don't know how to answer that.
No.
Everybody. I always felt that I had a host of friends. Not necessarily my age, but I had a host of friends that were older than I. Mm-hmm. And of course they're all gone, passed away, and I really miss them because I don't have anybody to ask any questions about anymore. Mm-hmm. I feel that I was fortunate to have all of those friends because they were good to me. We had a lot of fun together. And I had quite a few friends my own age group. But the older ones were always nice to me.
Do you remember any specifics?
No.
Your brother was how much older than you?
My brother was 2.5 years older than I.
And you all?
He's gone.
Mm-hmm. And you played together as children?
Well, neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun.
Did you?
Probably we didn't think we had much fun at the time. I remember we had, my brother and I had one bicycle. We had to share the bicycle. And when we would wear that bicycle out and have to get another one, we'd keep the old broken down one for as long as we could so that we had two bicycles.
How'd you get the new one? Did you have to work for it?
Work for it, save money.
And how did you, what did you do to earn some money? What kinds of things did you do?
Well, used to carry special delivery letters for the post office. I'd go there at 8 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock noon, and 6 o'clock in the evening. And any special delivery letters that came in for people, you had to deliver. So we delivered those with bicycle. And whatever money we got, we came home and put it in a tin can. It was a hole cut in a tin can. And we would just about accumulate $100 a year for the fees for delivering special deliveries.
And the two of
that was about the first job I had. Mm-hmm.
The two of you put your money together in the can.
Oh, yeah.
How did you get a job delivering special delivery mail? That sounds a responsible
thing. I don't know how we fell into that. Somebody said they need somebody, and I'm sure somebody did the job ahead of us. But
how old were you about that time?
Oh, my. 10, 12, something like that.
Do you remember any specifics of delivering special delivery? Was it a common thing for special delivery mail to come in, or was that?
Well, there weren't too many letters and all, but it wasn't very pleasant when you had to go from the post office here up to the top of Baker's Hill on a real cold, windy morning, you did it.
And then what did you all get paid to do that? Do you remember?
It was negligible.
Mm-hmm.
4 or 5 cents, or I don't think any of them were over 10 cents. Maybe if you had 3 or 4 letters, that one thing, you could end up with 20, 25 cents.
And did you get tipped by the people that you brought the mail to?
Oh, there weren't any tips.
No.
No tips. You only got what you made.
Right.
Yeah.
Were you usually bringing good news or bad news, or do you remember?
Well, I wouldn't have. No. It's all confidential. I mean, you'd go to the door and knock on the door, and people would. I think you did have to get them to sign for it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's about all I can tell you about myself.
Well, that's great, Mr. Spang. Thank you.